This episode of Landmine Radio is sponsored by Guido's Pizza. Located on International Airport Road in Anchorage, Guido's has been serving the best pizza, pasta, sandwiches, and more since 1984. Guido's is open daily for dine-in service from 11 a.m. to midnight, and they do takeout and delivery until 2 a.m. Whether I'm dining in a Guido's or ordering for delivery, the hardest part for me is always choosing what to get because they have so many amazing items on their menu. If you're looking for a quick bite or want to order food for a big party, Guido's is the place to go. Tell them Jeff from the Landmine sent you. Okay, back here in the Juno studio, and I'm with my buddy Neil Steininger. How you doing, Neil?
Good, good. How are you doing? It's sunny in Juno.
It's like
that's pretty nice.
50 degrees. I mean, it's great weather today.
I got out for a bike ride, Sandy Beach.
It's that kind of weather, and we'll talk about kind of the tenseness in the House and the Senate right now in this education, but it's the kind of weather that I always say, no matter how kind of fucked up things are with the legislature, when it's like this, people, especially in like May, people want to go home.
Oh, yeah. They want to go home. They also, like, the attitude and the feel of Juno changes.
Yes.
You're coming out of the winter. It's starting to get sunny out. Everybody wants to kind of enjoy life a little bit more.
Like, we're recording this right now on a Wednesday evening in the House, and we're watching it on the TV. The House is actually in session right now.
Mm-hmm.
There have a bunch of bills they're dealing with, but they have the windows. They can see outside. And they're, you know, the psychological impact of the Juno, because wintertime, you know, very dark, the mountains block the sun, so it's like kind of depressing.
Yeah. But yeah. Then, and I mean, I'm obviously biased because I live here in Juno, but there's nowhere more beautiful than Juno on a sunny day.
Now, you grew up in Juno.
Yeah. I grew up in Juno. Yeah. Lived here most of my life, you know, kind of off and on. And for the last, 12 years now, have been here.
And we'll kind of go into your background, but I think it's kind of cool. You had a stint in the defense contracting world.
I did. Yeah, down in Reno, Nevada. So went down there, lived there for just shy of a decade. Went to school, you know, got done with school and moved on and got a job with a defense contractor.
Now, you were saying we were having dinner recently, but didn't some of the stuff you sold, it was on TV in the botched Afghanistan pullout? Some of the planes you sold... Were the planes like the Taliban took?
Yeah. So the company that I worked for and a project I worked on there, we sold some fighter planes and sold them to the Air Force down in Afghanistan. And they ended up getting taken by the Taliban. They'd mostly all been scuttled before they got taken. But that was pretty, you know, interesting to see those pictures on the front page of the news.
Were you like, oh, my God, I sold that?
Yeah. It was like I called up a friend. I'm like, hey, is that our Embraer? Is that our plane? And they're like, don't worry. We disarmed them. Don't worry about it.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, for the folks listening, I think a lot of people know who you are. You were the OMB director, Office of Management and Budget Director, for about 4 years. And then previously you worked in OMB for quite a long time. And you came back to, so you were gone in Nevada and then you came back to Juno in
2012. Yeah. Came back to Juno 2012. Worked for Department of Revenue for a little bit in the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Worked for DOT doing procurement, statewide procurement. And then moved into OMB and, you know, worked there as an analyst for a couple of years. Kind of worked my way up to chief analyst. And then, you know, opportunity came up to serve and be director for the last 4 years. And you, that was pretty nice.
And you're an economist by training or by your
degree? Yeah, by education. Degree in economics and, you know, really working as OMB director, it's kind of the closest thing outside of like the Fed to macroeconomic, you know, kind of sought, you know, in a sense, you know, not to discount the work done by the economists over at Revenue or anywhere else, but, you know, that kind of big picture issues, big picture.
That's what I always tell people. I'm a 40,000 foot level guy. Big picture guy.
I like diving into the weeds, though, on programs and stuff. That's pretty fun. But yeah, it's, you know, macroeconomics is pretty interesting.
So you took over at OMB in 2020 after, was it after Donna Ardoin?
And then Amanda Holland, you know, shouldn't forget. Amanda Holland came in after Donna, was acting director. It really helped keep that place stable for a couple of months while they did the director search.
So for kind of like the, and this is like the wonky inside stuff, but when Donna took over, she had moved these, each department has a position like a budget person that used to be in the departments that kind of dealt with the departmental budget stuff and then I guess reported back to OMB. Is that kind of how it worked?
Yeah. They, you know, you had admin services directors in each agency who had a, just a variety, you know, pretty wide variety of work that those positions supervise in the agencies, you know, anything from facilities to HR to IT to accounting to budget, you know, a lot of responsibility lands on those shoulders.
And, and those under her, that those got moved into OMB, right?
They did. So yeah.
Like almost, almost like a consolidation of kind of budget people.
Yeah, budget. Yeah. Kind of seeing them as a sort of head individual in charge of budget for each agency. And that was kind of that consolidation at the start of the administration.
So are, now are those positions back into the departments?
They got they got rolled back into the departments. You know, when you think about it, with that variety of work that they're doing, you know, that's a lot of responsibility that the commissioner's held accountable for. Mm-hmm. You know, HR in a department or IT in a department, the commissioner's held accountable for. And so those eventually got rolled back in and, you know, that responsibility given back to the commissioner.
Yeah. So for the folks who watched the legislative stuff, you were, for 4 years, you were kind of a very familiar face. You were always in the House Finance, Senate Finance. You were basically, the OMB director is the face of the governor's budget, right? You're the person who presents the budget, answers questions, defends the budget against scrutiny or questions from legislators, right?
Yeah, yeah. That, and that's, you know, you're going in there, you're explaining, you're answering questions, you're, you know, giving information to explain what's going on in the executive branch. You know, they're, you know, there's always that analogy. They're the board of directors of state government, mm-hmm. you know, and so your responsibility is to explain that and explain on behalf of the executive branch and give them that visibility into what's happening and then advocate for, you know, the priorities of the executive and how to run,
now, prior
run
to,
that agency.
Prior to becoming director, had you, I imagine you probably had testified before.
A couple of times as chief budget analyst, mostly in a very technical arena, you know, explaining pretty technical items, you know, backing up the director at the time.
Do you, I'm sure you, do you remember your first like Senate Finance, House Finance meeting as director? Do you, I'm sure you have like a memory of that, or was it, cause you know, you knew most of those folks, but was it like intimidating or was it like a little nervous?
Yeah. You know, of course, like any new job, new perspective, you know, you're going in and you're, you know, not sure how you're going to be received, certainly, you know, but it was, you know, stepped in there and I at least had some familiar faces in the crowd to deal with. And so, you know, but it took some time, you know, you gotta build trust and build rapport in any job like that.
Yeah. You also, what I've always been kind of fascinated with or amazed with is you have to know so much because there's 15 or 60, whatever number of departments, they all have budgets. And then within those budets, they all have obscure things that you get asked about, like really in the weeds things, and you have to know the answer or be familiar with the kind of proposal or the project. And if you don't, you know, you have to get back to them. But I mean, when I watch you, you always seem to know like the most obscure things about something buried in some department, some moving, you know, $50,000.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing behind all of that, though, was, you know, 6 months leading up to that point where we're going through the budget process with every agency and I'm taking every opportunity to ask them questions. So, you know, there's a lot of time and a lot of people that are, you know, sitting behind you off camera that are helping, mm-hmm. you know, people don't really, you know, people watching the legislature, you know, you have 60 legislators, you know, you have each of them have, you know, 2 to 5 staff or whatever. And, you know, you think of that size and scope, but the executive branch is, you know,
way bigger.
15,000 PCNs. You know, you have the depths of resources that you can call on in these positions that are exposed to the legislature, whether it's, you know, a commissioner or an OMB director or whoever, you know, you have to remember that behind them are hundreds of people building up that mm-hmm. work, that are doing all of the groundwork to put it together. And so, you know, that individual that's there on camera, they're just there to present the work of just a massive amount of public servants that are behind them.
Now, you came in January 20, which mm-hmm. was right when COVID kind of started. I mean, it started kind of December, I guess, globally, but then by, you know, a few months later, it was fully on, you know, all the shutdowns and the legislature got out in like March. And then subsequently there was like the CARES Act and all these grants. And I mean, how much that must have been just a whole different kind of process from what normally happens. I mean, it was so much money and other mechanisms happening. What was that like dealing with all the COVID money?
Yeah, I mean, that was not what I thought I was getting into. You know, I saw it when I accepted the director position, you know, that we're, you know, the classic fiscal issues the state is facing, you know, the dividend fiscal plan, you know, revenue deficits, all of that stuff. And then COVID hits and it really pivoted to managing this influx of federal funds of, you know, working with the Department of Health and Social Services, working with the governor's office, working with everybody to put together that package and manage this just massive amount of money.
Price of oil went to below zero. It's, I mean, it was zero and then it was below zero. I mean, so we had this federal money come in, but then we had lost, you know, all for a while, all of our oil revenues, which, you know, it's interesting. We have the POFD, the draw from the permanent fund, which is, what, this year, $3.7 billion or something.
Yeah.
The 5%, which is a lot. But while oil isn't as important as it used to be as far as the percentage of where the money comes from, it still plays a big role because if it's high enough, we can do more. And right now it's in like the 80s, mid-80s. But when it gets down to the 70s, 60s or 70s, that has a huge impact.
Yeah. I mean, the POMV did a huge amount for stability in our revenue.
Oh, did I say POFD? POMV.
POMV from the permanent fund.
I was working on these POFD legislative reports earlier. That's why it was in my mind.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that did a huge amount for stability of revenue. You know, it's this baseline that kind of covers half of our revenue, roughly, you know, depending upon the year. You know, that's stable. You know, pretty easy to predict. You know, of course, markets go up and down, and that can change. But then, yeah, oil revenue during COVID, there are points where, yeah, it went negative. You know, it was, you know, definitely crashed down. And that POMV, even though it's very stable, it's not enough to cover all of the calls on the Treasury. You know, we've got a, what, you know, $5 billion budget. You know, 3.7 even doesn't cover that. So you still need, you know, these recurring traditional revenues, as we like to call them, you know, and those are still variable. And in some years, yeah, it's more than enough. You know, you look back a couple of years ago and we had, you know, enough to pay a really healthy dividend.
Well, after the Ukraine, and that's what I've kind of commented. I've said this about I've kind of joked he's Dunleavy's the black swan governor because, you know, he had the recall, which was a big issue for, you know, the first year. And then, you know, that was moving. The first round of signatures got turned in. And then the COVID thing happened, and that basically halted the because you had to get more signatures, and nobody could gather signatures anymore. So that stopped that. But then the second black swan event was when Russia invaded Ukraine. The price of oil went to 120, and the money just like at that point it poured in, right? Because it's kind of almost not exponential, but the higher the price goes, the more the state gets.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the big $3,200 dividend. It was an election year. And, you know, everybody wanted the bigger dividend is nicer during the election year.
Yeah, when you look at the, you know, highest and lowest oil prices that we've seen over, you know, whatever time period, you know, the highest and lowest are basically within his tenure as governor. You have negative oil prices, you have these really high prices, you know, maybe not the very highest. I'd have to go back to the numbers, but
in 08 or 09, the recession hit like 150 almost. That's a story I heard. Some people are still around. The spring revenue forecast had come in. This is 2009, maybe. And it was just way higher. So people had literally kind of like, I heard they'd run down, you know, people were out at the bars and they said, get back here. Each district has another like $1 million discretionary money. Because it was just so much extra money came in.
But then even with, you know, the high prices we were seeing in, you know, Ukraine wartime period, you know, wasn't sustained enough to give us crazy high revenue coming into the state. So, you know, we definitely put money back into savings. You know, we didn't have to have a draw on the CBR. We were able to rebuild in some ways, but it wasn't, you know, jumping back up to those peaks in that time period you're talking about, you know, in terms of dollar value coming in.
Somebody will look at $120 or $100 oil and they'll say like, oh, wow, that's great. But it has to sustain for a year, mm-hmm. for 6 months or a year to really
meaningful.
It can be high for a week or a month or a few months, but then if it goes back down, you know, it's we're working on averages here.
Yeah, and when you're looking at when you're thinking about, you know, I tend not to look at those weekly prices. Because, you know, when you're thinking about sustaining state programs, there's things that need to be reliable for a long time. You know, the public is sort of expecting the delivery of those services not to go away or come back week by week. You know, they're thinking about this in the year's time frame. And you really need to think about public policy in that long run. And so something like the Ukraine war, bringing in high oil prices for a short period, you can't run government off of that kind of luck. Or, you know, when you're talking about a war, but you know, you can't rely on those small events creating surges to run your long-term policy.
I totally agree with you, but they do. I mean, Palin did it when it happened in 2008-09. They had the energy rebate dividend. This last time, the dividend was really... Because the frustrating part for me is before that happened with Russia and Ukraine and the war, the governor, most of the legislature, there was the bipartisan, there was the, what's it called, the fiscal working group. You know, it was mm-hmm. members of each minority, each majority. They came in with a 50-50. The governor had come in with a 50 dividend.
Yeah, you had that whole report from that working group. Yeah,
that was a year of work. And remember the governor had a press conference in March of 2021. And I mean, Shelley Hughes was there. Mike Schauer was there. It was like this whole, a lot of these big dividend people and a lot of these smaller dividend people. Remember that big, it was like 20 people were at the press conference. Many of them spoke. Everybody was in for the 50-50. And then a year later, there was another press conference and the governor kind of came out with, well, we still need to get the extra, the back pay dividend from the last year. And most legislators went along with it because, you know, it's an election year. So, I mean, I totally agree with you, but history shows many times going back many decades when it gets good, they like to give,
that's the challenge in public policy is, you know, you have services that need to be, you know, and the basic core function of running government needs to be something that's sustained over the long term, but then you have these shorter time cycles and shorter time cycle incentives of, you know, when you see a spike in revenue. And that's one of the challenges in Alaska's fiscal structure is it's structured right now, even with the PMV and even with that base of stability, we're still structured to clip off the peaks of peak revenue and use those to work our way through the valleys. And that requires a lot of, you know, just wherewithal to
restraint.
Yes, thank you. Restraint to not spend up to your peak and to put it into your valley in the coming years. And that's hard.
I guess my next question that I wanted to ask you is 10, 12 years ago during that peak oil in 2008, 9, 10, we put a lot of money away into the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the CBR. Tens of, you know, 15, I think it was up to 16 or 17 billion. And with the statutory budget reserve, I think we were at like 18 billion in total savings at one point, 17 or 18. It was a lot.
It was a lot.
Between both accounts. And you know, the price of oil started going down. Deficit started in 2013, 2012. It really went down in 2015, where that was the first Walker year he was facing. I think it was a $3 billion deficit in one year. And it just, for me, we know this, we talk about this, everybody talks about this, but now that money has been basically almost exhausted. There's a couple of two or three billion.
Depending upon what they do this year and what revenue works out to, you know, they could have $3.5 billion left in those savings accounts.
Which is a good amount. I mean, it's better than nothing, but there used to be five times that.
Yeah.
And it's not just a spending it, it's what if that money stayed there? That earns money. There's a return on that money because it's saved.
Well, that goes to the question of, you know, what's the right amount of savings that the state needs. You know, that's a question that gets asked
the Neil Steininger savings number?
Well, so what I would say to that is, you know, we know that $16 billion wasn't necessarily enough. You know, maybe it was enough because we haven't crashed yet, but you know, we had that much and we've spent it all. So no amount's going to be enough if you don't have an underlying structure that that works better in the long run. And, you know, the POMV definitely solved a big chunk of that. That definitely has helped a lot. But there's still, you know, until you kind of have figured out that volatility issue in state revenue, until you've figured that out or figure out a way to smooth that, whether it's by the way you spend money or by the way you collect money, you know, no amount of savings can weather a, you know, statistical anomaly of a long-term.
Well, I was just, you know, a few weeks back, I was in Washington. My buddy Brian Fechter is living down there now. He's working for the government. And it's really interesting talking to him because they don't need as much savings as, because they have a very stable, I mean, they have sales tax, it's different kind of property, you know, it's very stable. The revenue doesn't really change much. Where here, because the revenue is so volatile with oil, we need, somebody like us needs more savings. It's like if you make 100 grand a year and you know you're going to make 100, you can live in a way where that's kind of comfortable. But if you know, you make 1 year, it's going to be 60, 1 year, it's going to be 120, and then 1 year, it's going to be set. You know, you don't really, you have to have a little more. If you're going to live on that $100,000 lifestyle, you have to have money saved up. More so than if you just had a very stable kind of income you could always rely on. It's not going to change.
Well, yeah. I mean, so as OMB director, you know, you go to conference with all the other OMB directors from the other states. And there's, you know, one that just, it really stood out to me. Another state was talking, and I won't, you know, mention what state it was, but another state was talking about how they had seen a downturn that year and how it was crisis mode. And they were trying to figure out how to manage to it. And it was a downturn of less than 1%. Their revenue off their projection. And were you into crisis mode.
Were you laughing? Were you like,
yeah, internally, I was like, well, that would be a great problem to have for Alaska. You know, and I, you know, looked at my email and looked at the most recent projections from the Department of Revenue. And I was like, well, you know, we're 20% off of our last official forecast or something at that point. You know, it's, we just have a much different structure than other states. You know, Washington has a much different structure than Alaska, much different structure than North Dakota, you know, and part of that is just the nature of what we are in Alaska. And that's that uniqueness of being here and the way that our economy works and the way that our state is. But, you know, some of it is, you know, byproducts of having, you know, really high oil revenue in the past. And that, you know, that transition that we are probably, you know, kind of midway through is still happening.
Well, on the flip side, I've heard, and maybe that's that same group, but I've heard that there's like a group that kind of looks at state savings, how much savings they have. And someone told me, I forget what group it was, but they actually don't include Alaska because of the permanent fund, because it would skew it. So like, because we do have a lot of money, but it's not money we can spend. It's protected, but no other state has, I mean, there's funds and there's different kind of, but as far as like the, based on the percentage, you know, amount of the budget and the savings, we are very fortunate to have the permanent fund compared to other states who don't have those kind of, those
very
funds.
Very fortunate to have that structure set up for us that has put that money away, that is now that nest egg that we're able to support services.
I mean, the permanent fund's about 70, so about 70 some billions, 80 billion, not quite 80 billion.
Yeah, I'd have to look. You know, they update it pretty much daily on their website.
We're like, our budget's 5, so we're like 8, you know, almost 20, you know, 18, 17 times our budget we have in savings. Which, I mean, think about a state like, you know, what, I think their budget's 100 billion. I mean, they'd have to have, you know, over $1 trillion or something saved to match that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking recently about the first oil lease sale, the 900 million, when they sold leases for the mm-hmm. slope. So that was $900 million. The budget that year was in the 60s, was $100 million. So the equivalent now is like, could you imagine if we had like a $50 billion windfall? I mean, that much just gives perspective of how crazy it must have been.
Yeah.
With just that much money.
Just much different times.
Coming in. So you did the OMB for about 4 years, and then you stopped doing that in August, and then now you're here. You're working with me on the Alaska Political Report, which is so glad you're helping me with that because
it's a lot of fun.
There's so much I can't do with the budget, and you know you're like the budget guy. But I guess what's it like Because before, every day you had to go to the legislature, you had to be live in that world, but you also probably had to, I guess not toe the line, but you're working for the governor who has a vision, but now you're kind of on the other side, so you can maybe say more, you can see it from a different perspective. So what's it like being on the other side?
Yeah, it's definitely a little different. You know, like you said, you know, when in my job before, you know, I had a, you know, we had an agenda that we were working towards. You know, you have the policies you're trying to advance, you have the initiatives you're trying to advance, and it's a different, you know, it's an advocacy role. And then working for you here, it's a political report, you know, it's much more of a, you know, explaining what's going on, you know, almost educating your readers, you know, letting them know this is what's happening, you know, this is what this means. And that, you know, it's, I kind of liken it back to, you know, in previous management roles where it's you're training staff. You know, it's not quite that, but you know, it's you're trying to, you know, distribute knowledge so that other people are more informed and make better decisions. And I see that as a big value in the political report is, you know, we're giving information, you know, we're trying to help people understand what's happening because most people don't have the time to learn the intimate details of what it is that you and I are watching. And if we can expand that knowledge out to people, that's better.
Well, even me, this is my sixth session coming down here, and I'm very good at, I can look at the political problems, I can analyze, I can explain pretty well what's going on politically with the people and the personalities and the politics. But as far as the budget, I mean, I look at these documents, I don't know what I'm looking at, you know, because there's so many documents, there's hundreds or thousands of pages, and you know, the governor does a budget and the legislature does a budget and they change it and it gets changed. I mean, there's probably 10 or 15 iterations throughout the process and stuff gets added, stuff gets taken out. And I mean, I almost feel like it's by design, very, very complicated because maybe it's not malicious, but like if it's so complicated, only a few people understand it. So it's much harder for the average person to, you know what I'm saying? Is that maybe?
I get where you're coming from, but I would kind of spin it in a different direction. I think the process and the tracking of the budget is as complicated as it is because it is there to serve the legislative and not just legislative, like legislative branch, but the deliberative process of policy setting. And that is a messy, complicated, sometimes illogical process where things move one direction, then they move another direction the next week. And the budget systems, reports, all of that are there to serve that process. And so as a result, they're really complicated and they're, you know, pretty Byzantine. They're kind of hard to read into. And so it does take a lot of expertise to know exactly what's happening, but it's not necessarily that, you know, it's designed that way to be obtuse. It's obtuse as a result of a really messy, complicated process that it is trying to wrangle and make sense of. You know, we're sitting here watching votes happen on the screen here on Gavel Alaska, and you know,
we're watching the self-storage units bill, and there's a number, amendment number 8, which just failed by 2 votes.
Yeah, you know, you've got stuff happening on a, you know, random weeknight evening, going in all sorts of different directions, and you just, it's being able to track that and make sense of it through a objective technical reporting process is a massive mountain of challenge that, you know, legislative finance is really the organization designed to address that. And they, you know, do a very good job of laying those reports out and making them publicly available, but no matter what kind of effort you put in there, it's still going to reflect the chaos that is legislative process.
So you and I have talked about this before, but, and I always go back to my buddy, Austin Baird. He worked for Channel 2 forever. And then he went to work for Governor Walker. And I ran into him months afterwards and I kind of said, what's it like being on the other side? You know, you're reporting over here and then now you're on the other side. And I'll never forget this. He said, I've seen more in a month of doing this job than I could ever hope to learn in like years as a reporter, because the curtain's unveiled, right? You literally see everything when you work for, you know, you have full access to all the information, where on the other side, you're trying to get the information and it's always, you know, it's kind of it's not a war, but it's, they have information. They don't want to necessarily give it. The people in the media want information. And oftentimes you're kind of in a room and it's a dark room and maybe you get something sometimes, but you know what I'm saying? It's very different kind of angles to the same issue.
Yeah, you know, it's the different, you know, roles that you serve, you mm-hmm. know. Like when you are working for the administration, you are, you know, gathering information to advocate for and advance policy. You know, when you are, you know, reporting on what's happening, you know, it's you're reporting on things that are public and happening, you know, and yeah, it is a different access to information. It is a different,
like, I remember, you know, the one
you're
time
not part of the deliberative process as a member of the media, you know, and you are part of the deliberative process when you're, you know, on the inside working.
Like,
for
I
the
remember
executive branch.
Couple years ago, it was like the budget was like kind of winding up, and I went to go to one of the restaurants and I saw you, and I was like, oh my God, Neil, what's happening? Like, what's going on? And you were like, oh my God. Remember that little Indian restaurant? That it was just like a coincidence. And, you know, because when you have that, when you're on that side, you know, by design, it's like, you know, you can't be, you shouldn't be giving the information away because it can, but you know, people like me want it, but it can cause problems.
So. Oh yeah, exactly. Because it's pre-decisional information too. You know, when you're working on deliberative information, you are trying to kind of investigate all different avenues, and you know, some avenues, you know, that you're investigating are not necessarily the avenue that's going to go forward, because maybe they're not, you know, really they're not the best policy, but you have to investigate those things before you can make a good decision. And so you definitely have different avenues you're looking at when you're on the inside versus, you know, reporting on what's happening, reporting on the decision is not necessarily mm-hmm. the deliberative side.
Yeah. So this session, you're kind of doing your own thing now. You're, you know, working with me on some political report, but other stuff. When you were doing your old job, because now you're watching committees, I assume you probably had the TV on, but were you like laser focused on budget and other stuff was noise, or were you still watching all of the things? I guess, what's it like viewing it from a position where you don't really have to be in a meeting every day or be presenting a budget every day?
Yeah, that was the interesting balance when, you know, and I think this is a balance that every state employee to a certain extent faces. When the legislature is going on, you know, you have to kind of split your attention between the job that you need to do serving the public, whether that is, you know, managing through day-to-day budget changes or working on an individual program, but you also are in the background monitoring what the legislature is doing. You know, there are bills before the legislature that impact every state program, usually. And, you know, so every state employee kind of has that in the background of, okay, what's going on over there that might change the work I do in the future? You know, in OMB, of course, you're much more, you know, kind of intimately connected because you are monitoring all the finance committee meetings, you know, monitoring all the budget process. You know, I showed up to a lot of hearings just to make sure I knew what was going on and being discussed, you know. And now, you know, it's kind of similar, but just a different angle. I'm not going to them. I'm watching them and reporting on them for your readers and making sure that, you know, kind of that expertise and that knowledge and the what's happening is being reported on for people to understand.
So I guess what's your take on, you know, early on, right away, education, they came out the gate, the House came out the gate with this education, and they were $300 BSA increase, and then it got eventually to $680, and then they had a bit of a delay on their bill. They had this internet schools bill, broadband bill, and then we saw what happened with that. It ended up passing, and there was a bunch of things in there. There was a little bit of a correspondence program increase for the mm-hmm. homeschooler, people who are living kind of remote. And then there was like a statewide charter position for charter schools. But the governor, he had wanted pretty clearly these bonuses, retention bonuses. He had wanted a charter program to be more, I guess, less local, more state. Is that right, characterize it that way, I guess, or have a more of a state role in the charter school system? Anyways, he didn't really get enough what he wanted, and he ended up vetoing the thing. And I guess I'm curious on your take on this education issue, which normally always gets dealt with at the end.
Yeah.
And it almost got dealt with in the middle.
Yeah.
Until it was vetoed.
And that when they first, you know, that second week of session, you know, that rules committee meeting where they laid out this bill, you know, my first gut instinct.
On a Saturday.
On a Saturday, yeah. Well, and it was, the gut instinct was, well, this is a, you know, keep your powder dry. This is an end, this is a second to last week of session negotiating point. And then the more that I thought about it, the more I was like, well, yeah, if you can get consensus on this big of an issue earlier in session, you know, you are basically, you know, taking that debate that was going to happen at some point anyway and front loading it and getting it out of the way. And, you know, I kudos to them for trying to make that happen, because if they had, you know, truly been successful and gotten that debate out of the way, you know, the headache and the, you know, conflict that they were going to avoid, that they could have avoided with this towards the end of session, that would have paid dividends, because, you know, you wouldn't have been fighting over the BSA throughout session. You'd have gotten that fight out of the way. You know, it was rough, those floor sessions where they were trying to work out that.
A month ago, they couldn't even, the House for a while, they couldn't even adopt, the majority couldn't even adopt their own bill.
Yeah, and it was difficult. It was getting it done earlier and getting out of the way to let them then focus on other issues. And now, you know, now that that hasn't made it through, you know, we'll probably see that debate happen in some form or another.
And you know, I actually understand, and I actually agree with the people who are talking about outcomes. And, we do have an outcome problem, and that should not be ignored. But we also, and what kind of frustrates me, and I liken this to, I'm on my condo board. I've been on my condo board for like a decade. Mm-hmm. You know, our budget's not huge. It's, you know, around 400,000. We have 116 units. Our dues for many years were 275, and they were actually a little higher a long time, but we got them down a little bit, and we kept them at 275. We tried, you know, we managed all of our, we have winter maintenance, snow plowing, we have landscaping, we have painting, we have insurance, you know, we have all these things. A couple of years ago, the inflation started and our prices went up. So we had to raise the dues to 300. 2 years ago, now 325. And we didn't want to, but we had to, just to maintain the same level of service, right? Mm-hmm. And even though we have to have a discussion about outcomes, and I believe that needs to really be addressed, the price, when was the last BSA increase? 2017, 2018?
2017 or 2016?
I mean, it was way before this inflation shit started.
Oh, yeah. So, and it was a like phased in, you know, step each year.
For me, the bottom line is outcomes aside, which should be discussed and which are very important. We have a real problem with that. Mm-hmm. All these energy costs have gone up. All these insurance costs have gone up. I mean, all these costs are, so to me, it's almost like dumb for people to say, well, we couldn't raise it for whatever reason. Well, the outcomes are a problem, but energy is going up. Electricity is going up. Gas is going up. Insurance costs, water costs are going up. And to me, it's just very strange that nobody's been, I mean, some people talk about that, but I think in the bottom line, you know, you have to pay those costs. I mean, I've heard about schools. Yeah. Do we pay the insurance bill or do we pay the heating bill?
Yeah. I mean, you have to, you know, reach that level of the hierarchy of needs, you know, before you can start talking about those value add things. You need to have, you know, shelter. You need to have the roof leak fixed. You need to have those things before you can start working up that hierarchy. And like you said, you know, you have to, any debate, any discussion about outcomes is also going to have to address the basic need of operating these organizations. And, you know, that doesn't appear to be happening. Maybe it will happen. You know, maybe after this week, that's where they pivot to, you know, but that's kind of optimistic thinking.
Were you surprised they didn't override? Because I talked to a lot of people and many of them were optimistic or were convinced they were going to override. Well, some of those same people didn't think the governor was going to veto the bill in the first place, and he did veto it. But I was pretty confident it was going to be very, I thought probably not, but I knew it was going to be very close, and it was so close, it was close by one vote. I guess, based on your kind of observation and watching, did you think it was going to get overridden, or were you not sure?
I was not sure. I thought it was kind of a coin toss. Leaning towards probably, just given you know, the testimony of the need that we'd seen through session up to that point. You know, but Sato is kind of a coin toss, you know, like sitting down doing that kind of back of the napkin.
I think I know for sure two of them, they told me this, but they were really unsure how they were going to vote up until the day of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was fluid. I was telling people, hey, you know, no one, the vote could be one way this minute, but the next minute could be a different, you know, a different outcome.
Yeah. It's funny. That was not an easy vote for any of them to make, I imagine.
So the Senate went first. And it was 16 yeses, 4 noes. So then the House knew they needed 24. You know, the people who knew how they were going to vote, they voted really quickly because the board lights up. And if you don't vote right away, have you ever seen that where the board will sometimes mm-hmm. people will switch their votes or they'll wait and you get to the point sometimes where it's like.
Votes are slow to trickle mm-hmm. in. Yeah.
So how do you see, you know, we're halfway through, more than halfway through. The 121 day session. You're doing a very great job with the budget. I mean, the House still has it operating. They're supposed to do some exchange of the, cause the Senate has the Capitol and they've basically agreed that they're actually going to physically like the OK Corral in the hallway, exchange the budgets to prevent the Senate from doing what they've done in the past where they've held all the appropriation bills until right before the end of session. And they go, here you go, take it or leave it.
Yeah, and I think it's great that they appear to have an agreement on process to avoid some of those sort of things that have happened over the last couple of years that have sort of broken down a little bit of the, you know, trust between the two bodies, if you will. I mean, that's a little bit extreme, but, you know, that have caused friction.
I think that's right. Yeah, let's put that on.
And that I think is great. You know, the reasons that a lot of those things happened, you know, really, it, you know, part of it started COVID kind of really messed up the process. You know, that first year kind of cut session short, messed up process. And there is kind of this, you know, sort of inertia towards the, you know, the omnibus appropriation bills. You know, everybody called them the turduckins. You know, the capital and operating budget together. And it kind of just turned into this thing that they were just ended up doing every year because it seemed like everybody said, well, okay, that happened last year. It's going to happen again. And I think this reset where they're saying, nope, we're going to pass the capital budget out of the Senate in time with the operating budget out of the House. We're going to hand them off in the hallway. We're going to try and get ourselves back to a process that makes sense that, you know, enforces trust. And I think if they're able to successfully do that, that'll be really important. You know, process doesn't drive policy, but it is still important that, you know, there's a process that people can rely upon and can trust. You know, for the public, you know, that adds a level of, you know, transparency to what's going on. You know, these capital budgets that, you know, showed up being merged into an operating budget late in session, you know, there were hearings, there were things that, you know, like tone-setting that you could see as a member of the public, but there wasn't a CS could point to.
They had the, at the end, they had the, I call it the wheel grease, you know, when they tried to get the House to agree, it was $30 or $40 million of little projects. And
last year.
And they literally had, some of them had the list and they wouldn't give it to me. And I mean, I finally ended up getting it way right before they went to the floor, but it's I was kind of like, well, why aren't you? I mean, obviously they were trying to convince people to vote to agree with it so they could get out. But you're right. In other cases, there would have been a meeting.
Yeah, there would have been a meeting. There would have been a committee substitute and a discussion or an amendment process or what have you. And there would have been a time span where the public could weigh in. You know, and I think getting back to a process that allows for that will, you know, it only will serve to increase trust in the system. And I definitely applaud both bodies for trying to work through a, you know, some kind of reset of that process.
So they're kind of saying they want to finish on time or maybe even a day early. Mm. It is an election year, which always motivates them to get out, you know, on time or early. But it's interesting because with the new ranked choice voting system, the primary isn't as big of a it's not a factor anymore. It used to be a factor for a lot of races, Democratic primary in certain districts, downtown Anchorage, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The winner of that's going to win. Other parts of the valley, you know, Republican primary, that's the winner of the race. But now it's this top four, and you know, last time I think one race had more than one legislative race had more than four people. And even that one didn't really, it wasn't like a big deal. So, I guess, what do you think? You think we're going to have the special session thing again, or you think we're going to get out of here?
I don't like taking bets on the future of what the legislature is going to do. I do think getting the budget resolved, it makes sense. You know, special session in the fall would be pretty disruptive. You know, of course, in an election year, that's pretty hard to get done. Maybe they extend 10 days, they have this agreement on a schedule, but. You know, nobody can say, well, oh, we agreed on the schedule that said we'd agree on this major political issue by this date. Well, that can't really happen.
The other issue that's been talked about, and there's been some hearings and there's a lot of bills floating around, but energy. And that's what the governor in his press conference kind of said, well, I'm done with education. We're moving to energy. And now I think he's in Houston for the CERAWeek thing, which, by the way, it's like, you know how much it costs to register for that thing?
No.
Fucking like 10 grand. I went to the website. I was like, maybe he's not paying that because he's speaking. Maybe there's a lower fee for officials, but oh yeah, 9,500 to go to that thing. Anyways, the Cook Inlet, you know, the gas, the issue with Anchorage and South Central last month, with the extreme cold temperatures and the power grid on the verge of failing. These bills are floating around. There's some in the Senate, some in the House. We're less than 2 months. That sounds like a long time. That's not that long of a time.
No.
When you have huge, I mean, this isn't like we're naming a bridge or we're, you know, moving some departments. This is like a whole different, this is a lot of money. And they've done this before 10, 12 years ago, the Cook Inlet recovery, you know, the exploration credits, billions of dollars. So I've heard even some talk of a special session in the summer on energy. Now, if that's going to happen or not, who knows, but it's being talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even if it's not not a budget special session, then.
And if that happens, I'm sleeping in that room right there. Because it's real expensive to live here in the... I mean, I remember when I came down...
Summer, trying to find a room in summer here.
Summer 2019, when they had all those special sessions, right? All You were OMB? Yeah. So I came down for a couple of days, and then I'd go back because it was like so expensive. I mean, the Driftwood I was staying before... By the way, I don't stay there anymore. Folks listening, don't stay at the Driftwood. This is me talking, Jeff Landfield. Don't stay there. It was like... $400 a night or something.
Yeah.
In the summertime. I mean, it was just prohibitively expensive. Because, I mean, all the tourists and all the workers and all, you know, all the, it's just, I mean, you're lucky. You got a place here, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I live here. I own a home here. I watch the boats show up in the summer and, yeah, the tone of town changes. But it is, yeah, housing in this town, summer fills up with tourism workers and
legislature and right there behind the building. I'm in the building across from the Capitol, my office, but. Yeah. They have the assembly building, and now they have those 34 apartments that I was convinced it was going to be like Animal House, Party House. Somebody's going to go into somebody's room and someone, you know, it's going to be drama. I was totally wrong about that. It's been very successful. All the people I know who are staying there love it. It's mostly staff. It's some legislators. I've been inside some of them. They are fucking nice. Have you been inside?
I've not been inside.
They're really nice. The only criticism I have is... legislators that are staying there, and there's only about, there's 30, I think 34 rooms, I think maybe less than 10 legislators are staying there. But the ones who are staying there, it's like ranges from, I think, 15 to 16. There's different, there's a efficiency one, there's kind of a one bedroom, there's different sizes. But in the interim, have you heard this? They can keep their stuff there and pay $50 a month.
Hmm.
And then if they come back for a session, they have to, you know, but they're, the argument is, well, because I was thinking, why don't they spent $10 million, I think, on renovation. Why don't they rent the Airbnb those babies out in the summertime, make some money?
Yeah, bring in some seasonal work.
If it was if it was our money, like we'd definitely be doing something with it. But I guess they want to keep it open in case there's a special session. But that's my only criticism is you have 34 really nice apartments that are going to be basically vacant during peak Juno season. I wonder what the other, maybe the other hotels and Airbnb type people like it because that would be a whole new set of rooms on the market. You know, maybe that would affect pricing a little bit. But yeah, $50 a month they can stay. But you should go check one of those out. They're actually really nice. I thought it was going to be Animal House.
Yeah,
it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's a old building getting renovated. It's good to know that they did a good job.
A few people even told me they don't even know who their neighbors are still.
That's a quiet building.
Yes, then. They haven't even seen them because they come and go at different times. So it's, but it's the other good part about it is it's like, I mean, walk to the, there's like this office here. You can walk to the Capitol in 30 seconds.
Oh yeah, they're just right across the street.
It's right there. So I guess last thing I'll ask you is, what's been your big takeaway so far this session, being on the other side of the session? Any like surprises, or probably sleep in a little more, I bet, huh?
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely catch up on my sleep. I'm a little more relaxed.
You look a lot more relaxed. You look great. A lot more laid back. Because when you left, weren't you? You were already going somewhere, right? You were already had a vacation or something.
Oh yeah, had a week long vacation planned already. Yeah.
So that must have been just because even when you were leaving, you're probably still always thinking about.
Oh yeah, what's yeah. The budget you don't really turn that off. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's nice looking at it from this side, you know, and kind of having a different perspective to kind of evaluate something with a cleaner perspective to evaluate what's going on.
I mean, yeah. I imagine, I'm sure there was times when you were in your old job as OMB director, you probably wanted to say something that you didn't say or you couldn't say, right? I'm sure there was opinions you had that are different from the guy. I mean, that's always going to be that way, right?
I mean, you always try to, you know, insert your perspective to try and, you know, make policy the best it possibly can. You know, you are trying to get things put together in the best constructed way possible. You know, and so you're trying to push in that direction in those positions to, you know, make sure that when you do bring something to the table, it is as strong as it can be. Yeah.
Well, I'm really happy we got, I mean, I kind of knew you before, but it was only basically, hi, Neil. We didn't really know it because we were on different sides, but I'm really happy we got connected and you've done an amazing job. And for the folks listening, if you don't get our Alaska political report, you know, get a hold of me, and we track everything from the budget to the politics, to the calendars of the commissioners and the governor, and the financial reports of the, you know, the campaign reports and their individual, all these different like tracking staff. And I don't know, there's so many things we do, the lobbyists.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll say, you know, when I was like you said, we knew of each other, you know, we knew each other would say hi on the street, but you know, didn't really know each other well, but like, you know, the landmine and, you know, your, you know, posting what's going on and giving that information was always an invaluable resource in terms of just, you know, you can't be everywhere all at once. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, hearing what's going on, and I think the political report is an extension of that, has been, you know, great. And working for you on that is, you know, providing that kind of information out to, like, to the people that get it, I think is pretty helpful.
I kind of joke that the political report is, I don't want to say boring, but it's just very like, here's the information. It's a lot of information. But even on the door, I have this, I mean, the political report, you see, that's very basic. It's very kind of, you know, but then the landmine is a little more fun.
Political report is less salacious. Yeah.
But the interesting part about the landmine, especially the landmine Twitter, is I don't know how many, I don't think you can tell, but there must be thousands of people with like Twitter alerts because, you know, you see something and you observe something in the Capitol, or there's some information you learn about somebody and you put it out there. And I mean, every time I've done that, especially about a person, like if they're moving offices or if they left or if there's some thing that goes down, I mean, they always tell me like, how do you, I just got like 60 texts or 50, you know, when something happened. So it's no, you're right. People do, you can't be in everywhere at once.
Yeah.
And there's so much happening, right? Like at any given time, I'll be during the day, you'll go to Gavel and you'll pull up, you know, the schedule, and there's like literally six or seven things happening at the same time.
Yeah.
Committees are meeting, this is happening, that's happening.
And you tell yourself, oh, I'll go back and I'll watch that this evening.
I never, ever do.
It's impossible. Yeah.
You gotta watch it live. Well, Neil, it's been just, I mean, a pleasure. Really, you've been such a good resource and you're just like, you're on top of it. So I'm glad you're doing this and we're having a good time, and we're halfway through. So
yeah, halfway.
A lot more to do. And then right after that, it's going to go right into the election cycle.
Yeah. Election cycle. We watch, you know, whatever budget gets passed out of the legislature, see what the governor does with SAD, and then see how everybody goes into November.
I think the issues to watch for, obviously, are education, energy, and there's a few other bills floating around, but those are the two big ones. The budget itself. And
the budget itself, there's, you know, this year has more, you know, discretionary capital in there. You know, you have match for some of those new programs, energy programs in particular.
We didn't talk about the dividend yet, but last year the House Finance Committee, the majority, did a 50-50. That was their proposal. It ended up going down. They haven't come out with their dividend yet, have they?
I'd expect that, you know, tomorrow they're going to release what's called CS2, Committee Substitute 2. So they did a committee substitute, a week ago or so, and that included all the subcommittee work and a little bit of other stuff from the co-chair's office. This next one tomorrow, you know, should, you know, ideally would include a dividend because now the committee has that spring revenue forecast. They know how much money they're working with. They should have a better idea. You know, last year, like you said, they introduced a 50-50 in the committee, and then the spring revenue forecast came out and made that.
Like a couple days later.
Yeah, a couple days later, and just tanked revenue. And so they were pretty reticent to include a dividend in that first CS. They wanted to see and that revenue forecast.
The 50-50 in itself was political in the sense that they had, first time ever, they had, the Republican majority had reduced the governor's proposal for the full dividend. So he had put in full day. He always does that. And then they had said, no, we can't do that. Now, later the Senate cut it down to the kind of 25% level, 25% of the POMV. But I don't know. I feel like it's an election year, but there's not a ton of money. They don't want to go in the savings. I'm guessing about 1,500, 13 to 1,500.
You That's know, kind of yeah. When I've ran the numbers, like you can pull off a 1,500 and still, you know, kind of get the savings balances to about that prudent level that the Senate Finance Committee keeps talking about, this $3.5 billion. You know, when you hear them talk about how much money they want in savings, they talk about $3.5 billion. You can get there with a $1,500 dividend at current revenue. So
what do they call the surplus dividend? That's the term.
It's pretty close to a surplus dividend. You can get a little bit higher with a surplus dividend. If you do that, you don't have much savings. You don't have much for capital or education or any of those issues.
Aren't we, and there's been some kind of back and forth on this, and I don't even know if they know the answer, but there was language in the last budget, or I guess this current year's budget from last session, about if the oil price is a certain level above 77 or something, we're going to get a bonus dividend of up to 500. But now I've heard some language about other costs and supplemental and the CBR transfer. So where's that at? I mean, we've talked about that a little bit. You've written a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it's roughly, I want to say it was like $218 in my back of the napkin mass that would go out to everybody based on current revenue projections. And so that's taking its revenue over like $6.2 billion. Any revenue over that gets split 50-50 between a surplus dividend and the CBR.
Will that be a separate check or will it be all in one check?
It'll be all in one check. So what it is it's a energy rebate like we had, 2 years ago? We had that energy rebate, not technically a dividend. That's kind of actually important for income tax purposes, as we learned 2 years ago, if you remember that. So it's an energy rebate, but it gets paid with the PFD. So that, like, functionally from an appropriation standpoint, it looks just like a dividend. You know, it's a deposit into the dividend fund, gets, you know, paid out with that dividend in October.
So I think I would say with that, I'm going to say 1500.
That's
my prediction for October. Folks listening, don't bank on 3,000 or 4,000.
Spending that money yet. unless it's to subscribe to the political report.
In that case, please. Get a hold of us and we should do a dividend deal.
Ooh, yeah.
On the political special. Yeah, we should. Yeah. I should do it. You gave me an idea.
The bigger the dividend, the higher your price is.
It's variable. Yeah. When I used to work, I moved here in 04 when I was 19 and I worked at Cal Worthington in 05. I started working there the early 05 and I worked there for a year selling cars. And I knew kind of it's like in the ether, people get paid to live here. You know, I didn't really know what it was. And then obviously I lived here and I learned about it. But man, they had these like dividend sales, you know, and people would come in the summer and they would do promissory notes. They would sign over maybe like the spouse and the husband or wife and their kids. And sometimes they would do like a, you know, big, you know, and they would sign over their dividend and it's like 2 or 3 months before, but it was a big marketing ploy or marketing gimmick for the car dealerships and the furniture stores and the electronics stores. You know, everybody would, I'm sure it's probably the same in Juneau.
Yeah. Yeah. Growing up, it was like that. Yeah.
Well, Neil, great talking to you, buddy. I'm so glad you're on board with the Political Report. We're having a great time with that. And
yeah.
Summertime's coming up and yeah, this weather stays like this. I can't even imagine.
I mean, I know it's going to be hard to sit inside watching hearings here pretty soon. You know,
I'll do my first Mount Roberts hike, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly.
Melts. Well, thanks a lot, Neil Steininger, former OMB director, now kind of freelance man on the street, just having a great time. Yeah. Taking a bike ride.
Yeah, took a bike ride earlier today and yeah, enjoyed the sun.
Well, I appreciate talking to you. Great perspective, and we'll do it again sometime. We just did over just an hour, so
yeah,
went by fast.
Cool.
Well, thanks a lot, Neil. We'll have you on again. And folks, if you have an idea for a podcast or want to do a podcast, get a hold of me and stay tuned for the next one.